where top executives and crazy entrepreneurs gather to talk about the future of electric vehicles. This is the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Driving with Dunn podcast. Okay, folks, buckle up because we are going way off-road this week. I mean, way off-road. I felt it was time that we pull back the lens and imagine how our societies might be controlled in the coming years, how we drive, where we go, who we see, what we say. So China today is building this powerful and suffocating surveillance system. We need to know about it. My guests today are Josh Chin and Lisa Lin, authors of a riveting and disturbing new book called Surveillance State. Josh and Lisa were ace reporters for the Wall Street Journal in China for many years. I knew them back in the day. We hung out until one day when they each got invited to leave China and not come back. In our conversation, they talk about why people in Xinjiang province despise the surveillance state while residents on the East Coast embrace it. They also share their own personal clashes with the surveillance state. What happened? And they confirm for us just how many cameras in China are watching over people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Can you say Big Brother? Is it 50,000 cameras, 10 million? Or are we talking about hundreds of millions? Let's find out right now on the Driving with Dunn podcast.
The Daily Drive podcast brings you all the news you need to know to keep up in the auto industry. I'm Jamie Butters, executive editor of Automotive News.
And I'm Kellen Walker. We give you all the top stories each weekday in interviews with experts like Mike Dunn explaining Jeep struggles in China.
How bad did it get as recently as June? Sales of Jeeps in China. Can you guess the number, Jamie?
Oh, gosh. Was it four digits?
It was one digit. And the number was one.
Listen and subscribe to Daily Drive at autonews.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Josh and Lisa, welcome to the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
Yeah, Lisa, great to see you guys both. I haven't seen you in a few years now, but we used to be buddies when we all lived in China at the same time. So I would like to, before we get to the book, which is phenomenal, by the way, I'd like to just set the stage a little bit, starting with some geography. We're going to talk about this big country called China, about the same size as the United States. And within that country, there's two different geographies and realities. One is Xinjiang, way up in the northwest, and the other is Hangzhou on the East Coast, an affluent city on the East Coast. So Josh, can you begin by just describing Xinjiang in layman's terms? How would you describe it to your best friend? What is this place up in the northwest of China?
Yeah, so Xinjiang is this, it's huge kind of swath of rugged land. It's about twice the size of Texas. It's kind of similar to Texas in that it's got a lot of deserts. Also has some mountains and some steppe. It's resource rich. Strategically located. And it's a kind of place that Chinese leaders dating back centuries have always sort of coveted, but also had a difficult time controlling. And part of that is because the people who live in Xinjiang, it's a bunch of different groups of people, different ethnic groups. Some of them are nomadic, others are farmers, but very few of them culturally have much in common with Chinese people. Most of them are Turkic Muslims. Culturally, linguistically, religiously, they're just very distinct from China. And if you go to southern Xinjiang, which is dominated by a group called the Uyghurs, if you visit cities there, it almost feels more like you're in Istanbul than in Beijing, right? And they've always kind of chafed at Chinese rule. And so the Communist Party has struggled for a long time. And occasionally the conflict has kind of broken out into violence.
Okay, so you have this border region, massive geographic space way up in the northwest, where, I remember as a teacher in China in the 1980s, first day of class, 90% of the students were Han Chinese. And then I saw a handful of people coming in looking like they're from the Middle East, from Turkey. Yeah, they were from Xinjiang. So dramatic differences in appearance, language, culture, food that they like to eat and all the rest. So that's way up in the northwest. Shift gears, we'll come back to the east coast of China to a city called Hangzhou, home of Alibaba, home of Geely Motors. What's that like, Lisa?
Yeah, I love the shift shift gears reference in a driving and car podcast. So Hangzhou is almost completely different from Xinjiang in many aspects. It's down by the East Coast. It's a 2-hour drive from Shanghai. It's definitely not as well known as Shanghai is, but within China, it's quite the tourist destination and it's quite the investment destination. And the reason why I say this is, you know, Hangzhou is home to a big tourist attraction called the West Lake, Sihu, which draws millions of tourists each year. And on top of that, Hangzhou has established itself as a city with, you know, with a lot of technology chops. So, for example, it's home to the Chinese internet giant Alibaba, as you mentioned, and it's also home to hardware makers such as the world's largest surveillance camera company called Hikvision.
Hikvision, I didn't know that, is based in Hangzhou. And they're the largest manufacturer of surveillance cameras in the world?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Hikvision. Anybody else in the space?
Actually, the second largest surveillance camera maker in the world is also based in Hangzhou. And that's called that's a company called Dahua.
Dahua.
So Hikvision, okay. Dahua, Alibaba, they're all headquartered in Hangzhou. And for that reason, Hangzhou's just done very well. It's one of those cities on the East Coast that you would consider a very wealthy and prosperous city. And unlike Xinjiang, you know, you'd see 95% of the people there are Han Chinese.
Okay, so homogeneous, wealthy, affluent, educated, everything's smooth and peaceful, almost like heaven on earth. Getting close. Yeah.
Visitors to Hangzhou in the 19th, 18th, and 19th century used to call it heaven on earth.
So. Heaven on earth. Okay. So we have this enormous contrast, two realities, one country, two different realities. Now, you talked about cameras. This is a stunning number to me. In the book, you talked about how many cameras are distributed around China to basically capture people, their behavior, their faces, etc. How many cameras are we talking about?
Probably about more than 400 million cameras. This is a third-party estimate because the Chinese government doesn't actually release the figures, and for good reason. But as of like 2021, you probably can expect about 400 million cameras in a population of 1.4 billion people.
400 million cameras. So like one for every three people, including infants, you've got a camera.
Yeah.
And these are no ordinary cameras, Josh. They're just highly sophisticated.
That's right. You know, I mean, one of the interesting things that people always have brought up to us sort of throughout our work on this topic is, oh, you know, what about London? London has the most cameras per capita, and which probably is true. But, you know, a lot of those cameras date to back when London was fighting the IRA, when the UK police were fighting the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. And so they're extremely outdated. They're installed in the 80s, you know, whereas China's cameras are state of the art, absolutely cutting edge. They have they're sort of powered by AI, which means they can recognize things. They can recognize faces. They can recognize objects. They can recognize people by the way they walk. There's a function called gait recognition, like G-A-I-T. And you know, the other thing they can also do is they can label surveillance footage in real time, right? So if they're recording a street scene, their systems attached to these cameras that will automatically sort of note, you know, if a car drives past, it will say, you know, like a red Tesla, they'll try to guess its year, model year. You know, or they'll say, you know, there'll be a pedestrian wearing a red shirt, someone on a bicycle wearing a green shirt, and it will label all of those images automatically, which makes video searchable. Right, which is just, if you think about what it used to be like for police anywhere trying to find someone in a pile of surveillance footage, they used to just have to watch it, you know, like go through hour after hour, and now they can just put it in search terms.
So
quite powerful.
If Lisa is crossing the street and Hangzhou is captured by one of these cameras, it very may well be the case that her name is there. Her hometown is there, her age, who knows, her occupation, it's all there.
Yeah, I mean, especially if she's on a watch list, which as a Wall Street Journal reporter, she may be, they could have all of that information kind of automatically attached to any image of her that's captured.
And all of this information flows up into what's, I guess, called the Public Security PSB Bureau. Is that the godfather of the surveillance mechanism in China?
Yeah, you know, it's I mean, that is the thing that makes China really unique in all of this. And, you know, I mean, there's state surveillance everywhere, right? I mean, mm-hmm. in some ways, states don't really function without surveillance, right? They need mm-hmm. to know how to track people, how to, you know, who lives where and how much they make, so they know how to tax them and that sort of thing. But where China is unique is that it collects massive amounts of data through these cameras, through smartphones, through online payment systems, and they have more or less direct access to that data. And it's different government agencies, but the Public Security Bureau is one of them. The Ministry of State Security, which is sort of like the NSA or the CIA, China's version of the CIA, or NSA probably closer. But China is unique as a government in that in most other countries, this data is really scattered, right? Some of it's owned by companies, some of it's owned by, like in the United States, like the DMV, right? Mm-hmm. Different agencies that don't really talk to each other. But in China, the government can act like as a singular entity that can access all of this data. And that's what makes it really powerful.
That's a great contrast. So DMV, we think, oh, they're gathering it, but they're so inefficient and so bureaucratic that I'm going to get lost, buried in the records. I'm in good shape. But in China, yeah. Just the opposite.
Exactly. Anyone who's dealt with a DMV can be relatively confident that that data is not being shared smoothly with other arms of the government.
Yes.
The other thing, Mike, that I would probably also add to that is, you know, the Chinese authorities also have free access to data from corporations. So think about, you know, China's version of Amazon or Google or Meta. In China, it would be Alibaba and Tencent. And it is very easy. The laws that China has set in recent years has made it very easy for state security agencies to go to these companies and ask for data on certain individuals. So that means, you know, China doesn't just have the DMV's data. It has like data from Amazon and Google and Meta at its fingertips if it wanted to.
Now, when you say ask, is it ask or hand that stuff over? We want it.
In paper, it's ask, uh-huh. But you know, the difference between the US and China is in the US, if the police want something from a corporation, mm-hmm. they have to get a judge to sign off on that warrant. Okay. In China, it's very simple. If the police want something, a more senior police officer just has to sign off on that warrant, and the companies really have no way of saying no.
Okay. All right. So I want to come back to your own personal experiences on the ground living in China, but let's go to the book, and in particular, start at the beginning with the opening scene of the book, which was really dramatic. We have a guy back in Xinjiang named Tahir and his wife, and they've been summoned to a police station in the city downtown in Urumqi, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what's going on there? What they're in the basement of a police station. Why have they been summoned there? What's going on?
Right. So this was in early 2017, and at the time that the Tahir and his wife were called into this police station in Urumqi, there was a new Communist Party boss in Xinjiang who was rolling out a new campaign, and at the time, it wasn't clear what was going on. There were sort of police stations being built everywhere, new surveillance cameras and security checkpoints going up. And then there were sort of rumors at the time of people in other parts of Xinjiang being dragged off to quote unquote, go to school or be educated. And no one really knew what that meant, but I mean, obviously it didn't sound good. And so
nobody likes to go to school.
no, and especially if they were being dragged there involuntarily. And so Tahir, who's a considered by some to be one of the greatest living Uyghur poets, as a fairly well-known cultural figure in Urumqi and Xinjiang, and sort of traveled widely, was a, you know, sophisticated guy, had connections abroad. He's called to this police station with his wife, ostensibly to have their fingerprints taken, which they thought that's kind of strange because the police definitely have our fingerprints. But they had no choice, and they went and they got there, and they realized as they were standing in line under these kind of harsh lights, they're in line with a bunch of other Uyghurs, and they realize that all the other Uyghurs there are also like them, people who have connections overseas or who've traveled and you know, but none of them know why they're there. And so he goes and he kind of gets to the end of the line and then basically goes through this gauntlet of biometric data collection, right? So they do take his fingerprints, but they also take his blood. And they make him read a newspaper article aloud so they can record his voice.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Like out of a movie.
Exactly. And at the end, it sort of culminates with this 3D face scan where he's sort of facing this camera lens that he's never seen before. And he's got to move his head up and down and to the side and then make a O shape with his lips and do all this sort of stuff. And he has to do it at just the right speed. And he has to do it without stopping. And it takes him a few times to get it done. He's kind of bewildered by all this. He has no idea really what's happening. And then his wife goes through it all and they sort of get out. And they kind of go into the city, and then, you know, over time it kind of dawns on them what that was, right? And that was basically that they're all that information has been entered into this system that has been installed in Xinjiang to track and categorize Uyghurs, right? And to and basically the idea is to sort of predict based on surveillance data which Uyghurs are likely to resist the Communist Party in the future, right? Mm-hmm. These are not people who committed any crime, been involved in any kind of conflict or attacks or anything like that. They're just people whose behavior the Communist Party thinks might be suspicious, or the systems that the Communist Party has set up think might be suspicious. And so then throughout the rest of the book, he's kind of trying to contend with this and basically trying to figure out a way to get out of Xinjiang.
Yes. You also reference there's a questionnaire that comes from the police, and at the end of the questionnaire, it looks like an area for the police themselves to fill out. And it's just got three categories for summing up that individual, right? What are those three categories?
So the three categories are essentially safe, neutral, or unsafe.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're unsafe people. And obviously the safety being considered there is the Communist Party's safety, right? The level of surveillance was just totally suffocating. If you were a Uyghur, just going about your day, any bank, any market, any hotel you would have to go through, you wanted to go through, you would have to do a security scan. You would have to
gas stations.
Yeah. If you wanted to get gasoline, that was one of the most surprising things when we went there. We discovered, if you want to get gas, you've got to scan your face. Everyone has to get out of the car except for the driver. All of the gas stations are surrounded by security, barbed wire, security fences, and only one person can drive in. He has to scan his face. And then at the pump, you scan your ID card and it records how much gasoline you buy, right? So the idea is that they're trying to track, make sure that people aren't stockpiling gasoline for bomb making or something like that. But it was, we're walking down the street, at any given time, a policeman could just stop you and ask you to hand over your cell phone, your smartphone, and then have it scanned. And if there's anything they consider contraband, you could be, categorized as unsafe. And that includes, things as innocuous as like photos of Turkish movie stars, right? Or encrypted chat apps like WhatsApp, stuff like that. And then the consequence of being labeled unsafe was that you were sent to school, what turned out to be a network of internment camps, sort of political re-education camps, where people were often tortured in addition to sort of being subjected to brainwashing.
Josh, a couple of things you said there. One is suffocating. That's the overwhelming sense I got as I was reading it. These families are there just terrified of every move they make, everywhere they go. And the other one was when they're standing in line, they don't know exactly why they're there, but at the same time, they don't dare to ask. They don't want to meet danger halfway. That's a kind of torture in a way. As I was reading, I thought, okay, just shoot me. This is right. So a death by execution may be better than what I'm feeling right now as I try to imagine the people in those basements with the police.
Yeah. And it was, and kind of out on the streets as well, most Uyghurs were at a certain point found themselves kind of living in an open air prison. Right. And we met one guy, he actually doesn't appear in the book. But one of the people we met there was a fruit vendor who had neglected to pay his cell phone bill for several months in a row. So he had a black mark on his record. And every time he went through a security gate and scanned his ID card, an alarm would go off and he wouldn't be allowed to pass. So he was essentially trapped in his own neighborhood. He couldn't leave.
It's Orwell in spades, right? 100%. All right. Lisa, back to you. Just when we're ready to say, oh my God, let's dismantle this system immediately. It's a horrible thing. You encounter people, everyday people in Hangzhou, parents sending their kids to school, walking down sidewalks, who actually go, hey, this is a pretty good system. We like it. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is one of the discoveries as we did our research, because, you know, when you think about state surveillance, you immediately think about it as this nefarious and very creepy thing, because who likes to be watched, right? Mm-hmm. And so as we were doing research, I found that the state media had been trumping up the same surveillance systems and the same sort of technology and cutting edge AI that was used in Xinjiang was being used in other parts of China in ways that when I went down and I interviewed residents, they all found very attractive and they all found very beneficial. And the reason why, you know, I circled in on Hangzhou was because Hangzhou, as you mentioned earlier, it's home to Alibaba and it's also home to Hikvision. So it's really embracing of all sorts of technology to just make its city governance, to make its city run just smoothly. And in Hangzhou, what I encountered, and maybe I should back up a little bit, Hangzhou is a city where the road networks have not changed in the last 40 to 50 years, even though its population in the last 10 years has more than tripled. So you have, you know, instead of in the past in 2010, more than 3 million people using the same roads, now in 2020, you have almost 12 million people and much more using the same roads in Hangzhou.
12 million people in Hangzhou.
Perhaps, yes. And that's just in the direct Hangzhou region. Hangzhou still has city sprawl, so there's a broader Hangzhou region as well.
I can feel listeners out there scrambling to Google going, Hangzhou, how do you spell that? 12 million? What? Okay. Big, densely populated city, high tech, relatively affluent.
Exactly. And I'm not sure if you've been to Hangzhou when you were in China. You probably were there multiple times because Geely Automobile is headquartered in Hangzhou. And anyone who's been to Hangzhou in the last like 10 years has experienced what you call a jam, very bad congestion during the peak hour. And what Hangzhou essentially did was to install networks of cameras at every road intersection and to combine that with GPS data from your car to make traffic lights turn, you know, stay green for longer when there was heavy peak hour traffic. Or in the case of, you know, there's always a traffic accident that's clogging up some highway. And that takes like ages for the accident to be cleared. And then people are just waiting in line, waiting for that accident area to be cleaned up. What the Hangzhou system also does is these cameras spot quite quickly when an accident has happened, because the AI is trained to spot when an accident happens on the street, and it immediately alerts like the first responders and the traffic police to go down and clear the scene. And that's just traffic, right? Hangzhou uses the same sort of systems in Xinjiang, and they use it instead of spotting like Uyghurs or people whom they deem as national security threats. They use that same facial recognition system to spot drug offenders, fugitives on the run, the same sort of people that as parents, you really don't want to be wandering around the street with your son and daughter. So there's a lot of perks, I guess, to the residents in Hangzhou for these surveillance systems. And when you talk to them about it, the residents know that they're being tracked, and they know that the cameras that's installed on sidewalks, in front of schools, in front of hospitals, they know it's reading faces. But for people, it's a trade-off that they're willing to accept, because they see positive externalities in return.
Right. As I was reading that chapter, I was thinking to myself, wow, so in a way it's, yes, they're willing to accept that compared to what? So they probably have not lived outside of China. So what they know is a crowded city with potential for robberies and thieveries and accident run, hit and runs, and think, oh, this system improves the overall safety of our conditions. But compared to what was the question that kept coming back to my mind. So,
Mike, yeah. I would probably add to that. A lot of the Chinese outside of Xinjiang have very little idea of what's happening in Xinjiang. So for them, the concept of the surveillance system is what they know and read in the press. But because of China's Great Firewall and its propaganda and censorship system, you know, mostly it's been the Western press that's reporting about the atrocities in Xinjiang, and all that's censored in China. So the Chinese citizen only hears what China wants, the message that China wants to deliver. So for them, they have no idea what is the flip side.
They're not aware of a downside, more or less. They just see the upside. Okay.
Yeah, that's wow. Right.
All right. Let's talk about you guys. You guys are world-class reporters on the ground in China. How does the surveillance system shape your life? Do you feel as though you're being watched? If so, how? When? Any direct experience with it so far? Josh, you want to take that one on first?
Yeah, you know, I think any foreign correspondent who works in China for any amount of time actually probably is aware of the possibility that they're being tracked, and probably kind of lives with that all of the time. But you know, one of the ways it works is by being ambiguous, by being sort of inchoate. You know, you're never quite sure what happens. So you know, what often happen, you know, no matter how many precautions you take to sort of to protect your sources and that sort of thing, inevitably at some point you'll have an experience where you've interviewed someone on a sensitive story, or even maybe a not sensitive story, and then they'll call you back a day later and they say, hey, I got a visit from the police, can you not quote me, or I need to retract everything I said to you. And you just never know, was it your phone that was being tracked? Was it something that you did? Were you incautious, or was it their phone, right? Or was it a camera outside their apartment or whatever? So, and I think that's partly the point, right? The point is that you're supposed to know that it can happen, right? You know, the one time where I did have a direct experience of it though, that was really personally instructional, instructive, was in Xinjiang actually. And I mean, you'll appreciate this. The first time I visited, I went there with a colleague, and we drove in. We rented a car from Gansu province, which is the neighboring province, and we drove into Xinjiang because we were worried that if we flew in, the airport surveillance would pick us up, right? But we didn't realize, of course.
You're in Gansu. How far from Gansu to Xinjiang? It's not that close, right? It's like a few hundred miles?
Or? Yeah, well, we were like the Dunhuang area, so it probably took us like a good two and a half hours to reach the border. And then, of course, from the border, you know, it's such a huge region, driving into Urumqi was another 2 days. Yeah. But, you know, what we didn't realize is driving in, there would also be immense surveillance. Like as soon as you cross the border, there's this humongous security checkpoint. And, you know, with these big burly soldiers carrying assault rifles, and you have to go through and you have to park your car and then go through and have your like a full body scan and all this sort of stuff. And then there are security checkpoints at every point along the highway, you know, probably every half an hour, every hour, you have to do it again, you know, and get.
You had to get out of the car, Josh. You're there as a reporter for, at this time, the Wall Street Journal. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And you cross what is a border between states or provinces. And suddenly, unlike other borders, this border is jam-packed with cameras and surveillance and personnel.
Yeah.
Get out of the car.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, it was sort of like entering a whole new world. It was like driving into a sort of dystopian counterinsurgency operation with no insurgency, right? There are no armed resistance in Xinjiang, but it seemed that way. And so at one point when we were reporting, I mean, we saw all the cameras and everything like that, but you know, our major personal experience was we were driving around at one point in the desert, kind of lost, trying to find our way back to the highway. And on this just dirt road in the middle of nowhere, no one around, no houses, and nothing like that. And all of a sudden, you know, there's this huge cloud of dust surrounding us. And we kind of came to a stop. And when it cleared, we saw that there was a police car up in front. And then another police car pulled up behind us. A bunch of officers get out. They order us out of our car and they start interrogating us about what we're doing there and all this. And we're just like, you know, hearts thumping in our chest.
Yes.
What is this? And, you know, finally we persuaded them to let us go. And as we were leaving, I turned to one of the guys. And I was like, how did you even know we were here?
Uh-huh.
You know, like, we didn't see you at all. And he's like, oh, we had our cameras back there, recognized your license plate and alerted us. And you know, it was just amazing, you know, to experience that. And you know, as a reporter, as a foreign reporter in China, the worst that can happen to you is you get kicked out. Right. So I can only imagine, you know, what it must feel like to be subjected to that kind of surveillance when something much worse can happen to you.
Josh, you mentioned getting kicked out. You weren't kicked out of China, were you? You were invited to perhaps visit another country and not come back, or what happened there?
No, actually, oh, yeah. So in my case, I was actually expelled.
Expelled, formally.
Expelled, along with two colleagues. This was the beginning of 2020. And, you know, to be honest, we're not really sure exactly why. There was the ostensible reason is that the Wall Street Journal had written, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is completely separate from the news operation, had written a headline that a lot of some people found offensive related to the pandemic. And so the foreign ministry had kind of whipped up a lot of attention around that, and then basically expelled me and two other reporters, which kicked off a whole sort of media war between China and the U.S. A bunch of mutual.
How does one get expelled from China? Do you get a phone call, an email, someone show up at your door? How does that work?
In my case, they were they called my bureau chief in and told him, and then he told me, and I actually happened to be at the foreign ministry. I'd gone with him when they told him. When they informed him. And then, you know, we actually thought we had some time to maybe try to reverse it, you know, try to lobby the foreign ministry. But then half an hour later, they announced it at a press briefing, at a regular press briefing. And that was it. They had 5 days to pack everything up and get out.
5 days.
5 days.
Oh, all right. Now, Lisa, you're still based in Shanghai. Is that right? Or it's dividing your time between Singapore and Shanghai?
No, not over the last 2 years or so. I left Shanghai end of 2018, okay. But I went back a ton in 2019 for the book. Okay. So now I'm based in Singapore, okay. And it's been very hard to get a journalist visa to China. So,
well, of course, because you're
the number four reporters. Yes. And the foreign and the state security know that, so they're not
right. They have your facial recognition, and along the bottom it reads, close friends with Josh. In fact, co-author with Josh. Hey, Lisa, let me ask you a question. You were living, breathing, eating. You were living the surveillance state firsthand. Did you ever have a feeling like you had a personal encounter with the system itself?
Yeah. So, you know, I first got to China in 2010, and then I left really right at the end of 2018. And for me, you know, understanding how China worked and the surveillance that it involved came very early. Josh talked about the digital aspect of surveillance. My brush and encounter with surveillance was a lot more low tech. And this was in 2011. That was, you know, we were just off a very successful, you know, Arab Spring, where in the Arab states in the Middle East, you had seen countries such as Tunisia, Libya, essentially have its citizens rally together over social media and effectively overthrow some of the authoritarian dictatorships there. In China in 2011, you know, the mood was quite similar. We hadn't encountered the Xi Jinping era yet, and this was way before China had tried to put in a lot of the internet controls and the data controls that it has today. Back then, Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao were still in power, and it was towards the tail end. So a group of people in China decided they were going to emulate what was happening in the Arab states.
Oh, boy.
And organize.
Here we go.
Yes. Uh-huh. And organize their own pro-democracy protest in cities like Beijing and Shanghai. And they, back then, I'm not sure if you remember this, Mike, but they called it the Jasmine protests.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a series of protests that they had used Weibo to organize, essentially calling for people to meet at a certain hour in a predetermined location. And the protesters, it was a silent protest, so the protesters were just supposed to walk around and not have any like outward emotions that they were protesting. So I covered that event for my former employer. I wasn't with the Wall Street Journal then. And the story ran the next day with no byline.
So no byline. So where, you were in Shanghai, or where did you go to cover this event?
This was Shanghai. So okay. I was at People Square.
People Square, right in the heart of the city.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a very touristy destination. So it was hard to tell because, you know, the protesters were just asked to turn up and look normal. Mm. So I covered the protest, and the story ran that day with no bylines. So you wouldn't be able to trace who the reporter was for the story. And the very next day, I got a call from the Shanghai Exit and Entry Bureau. They're part of the Public Security Bureau, which is the Chinese police. And they called me down and they said, "Do you understand the rules and regulations of reporting in China? We knew you were at the Jasmine protests. We knew you were reporting there. Can you sign this document saying you understood, you understand the rules and regulations for just retaining your J visa and reporting in China?"
So they summon you to their office and they acknowledge that this event did happen. And then they said, "By the way, we know you were there and you wrote up the story." Did they ever say you're not, well, I guess they're saying you're not permitted to do that.
Essentially, yes. It was sending a very clear message that they didn't like what we were reporting about. And it was interesting to me because I wasn't outwardly interviewing people at People Square. What I would do is I would see people walk by, and if they walked off to the side street, I would approach them there. So it wasn't as if I was going around with my pen and my notepad and a recorder in my hand, right? So that was very, very creepy to me. And to this day, I have still no idea how they did it or how they found out. But, you know, there are a couple of guesses that like reporters in China have come up with. For example, that the PSB were there. I mean, the Chinese police were there, and they were recording the scene with a video recorder, and they recognize our faces. And this is human face recognition. So a person is trying to recognize me and pick me up from the crowd. And that's how they did it.
Before cameras.
Before facial recognition cameras. Mm-hmm. So it was a human person watching the footage, trying and spotting, okay, this is a Western media reporter. So that was my early lesson into the way things were done in China.
Xi Jinping in your book is on record as saying, you know, we're actually pretty proud of our system. It's a China solution for humanity in search of, he says, better social systems. Do you see China seeking to export its system globally, this be the new standard for how a society should be run, backed by the surveillance system?
Yeah, they definitely are exporting these systems. There's research that a friend of ours, Sheena Greetens at the University of Texas, did that showed these exports have gone to at least 80 countries worldwide. Chinese state surveillance systems.
80 countries.
80 countries, including a few democracies, police stations in like small towns in France, yeah, for example. And that, you know, the technology companies themselves, companies like Huawei, claim to actually have sold much more widely than that. But 80 is what we can sort of independently verify. And, you know, then the question is, what is their intention? And I think that's a little bit of a harder question to answer. I think they have a multiplicity of motivations. One is certainly commercial. I mean, these companies make a lot of money, and you know, Hikvision and Dahua, these companies, they've already sold, as we said, hundreds of millions of cameras inside China, and China's sort of saturated with cameras now, so they do need other markets to sell into. So I think that's one major motivation. And China is, you know, they also are happy to, you know, governments who are interested in these systems who also want to know how China uses them, the government is happy to train them in it. You know, they'll bring over delegations of police to Beijing to sort of learn how to use it. So they are promoting this idea and this system. Whether they want it to sort of take over the world is another question. I think they're sort of just happy for people to kind of follow their example, or just they're just happy for governments to use these technologies for control in whatever way they see fit.
I was just going to add that, yes, China is exporting these systems, but when we did our research, we also found that a lot of the systems that were exported overseas never worked as efficiently as it did in China. And that's for a couple of reasons. The first reason is really that China has the perfect like database for them to pinpoint, you know, to pinpoint a face to a person, for example, because with your ID cards, you have your ID card number, you have a face, you know, you have a picture attached to it, you have your address, you have your hukou. There's a lot more details in that database than, for example, if an African country had. African countries are still in the midst of trying to introduce identity cards. So not everyone has an identity card number. So it's hard to pinpoint like a face to a person if it were used in such a context. Whereas in China, it's much easier. Your mobile phone and everything is tied to one ID. The systems just work a lot better in China for that reason. And the second reason is because, you know, the AI algorithm that powers these systems were trained on Han Chinese faces or ethnic minority faces. And we know that algorithms don't translate as well from one culture or one ethnicity to the other. So when used in places like Africa, for example, the algorithm's efficiency and the facial recognition accuracy just drops. So it's not as efficient as the systems in China are.
Final questions, guys. No podcast. Driving with Dunn podcast is complete without some knowledge of how you guys get around. So very quickly, what do you drive? If you don't drive, what's your preferred Uber or Lyft or Didi car?
Oh, I grew up in Utah and I used to drive an old 78 Toyota Land Cruiser back then. These days I don't have a car because I travel around so much. I'm based in Seoul now, so it's a lot of cacao taxis. Mm-hmm. Uber is moving in there soon. One other car thing I will say is, you know, black cabs in Xinjiang was one of the few places where you could actually conduct interviews because they didn't, all the cabs in Xinjiang have cameras and microphones in them, not surprisingly, but there were black cabs sort of run by Uyghurs where you could catch snatches of conversation.
Oh my goodness, that's so interesting. So the taxis have cameras and microphones too. There's no whiskey. You can't get into a car and go, let's have a private conversation now.
No.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Lisa, how do you get around?
Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say this, but after living in cities for so many years, I have a driver's license, but I've forgotten how to drive. So these days I get around by using the Singapore equivalent of an Uber. That's Grab. Uber tried to come in, but eventually after a close fight, they bought a stake in Grab instead. So I tend to use public transport though, because I get car sick, and in China I was car sick all the time.
Ah, me too.
Because the drivers were so bad.
What do they call that? Can't decide stop or go. It's sort of like that.
It's just the constant braking. Yeah.
Guys, phenomenal book. Thank you so much for joining me today. Last thing, how do people find the book? What's the easiest way to get the book?
Yeah, I mean it's on Amazon, all your sort of online bookstores, Barnes & Noble, should be in major bookstores as well. I think we saw copies in the San Francisco airport if you're flying through San Francisco.
Beautiful.
So, and probably other airports as well.
Congratulations. Phenomenal book at exactly the right time. Thank you, guys. Keep going. Keep doing great work.
Thanks, Mike.
Jenny. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah. Bye-bye. I still remember during my first year in China, that was 1986, a Chinese friend of mine asked me to go for a walk across university grounds with him, far away from other people. That's when he gave me some intel, some tips about how to behave. He said, Mike, there are no secrets in China. What you say and what you do will be known by the authorities. Now think about that. That was years before cameras, before AI, before this suffocating surveillance state. Yeah, you know, the one backed by 400 million AI-powered cameras. So what does that have to do with people living outside of China? And what will be the impact, if any, on the future of cars? Well, a couple things come to mind. One, Chinese AI-powered cameras are already exported to more than 80 countries. We learned that from Josh and Lisa today. So our profiles, let's be honest, are probably already in Chinese data banks. Second, China will export a record 3 million cars globally this year. Now, some, an increasing number of them, will be equipped with autonomous driving systems and those powerful cameras. And yes, the data vacuumed up by those cars will belong de facto to the Chinese state. It's not just a China thing anymore. We need to wake up to this reality. Hey, I hope you learned as much as I did from this episode. It was fascinating. It was traumatic, scary, all of those. Don't forget to take a moment to give us a 5-star rating and share this episode with a friend. This is the Driving with Dunn podcast.
Thank you for listening to Driving with Dunn. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. And to reach Michael Dunn, go to zozogo.com.